This brings us to the, I guess it's the fourth chapter, isn't it? Last one was about the specialness of water. This chapter is about the specialness of carbon. Now, chemistry is an immense science. It's huge. But there's kind of a dichotomy within chemistry based on carbon. There is organic chemistry and there's inorganic chemistry. And what is the definition of organic chemistry? What is organic chemistry about? What's the definition of organic? Yeah.
I'll just say like an organism that at least has molecules and a cell in it.
Not... That's why the word got started, but no, not anymore.
Okay.
Organic means of organs. And so, originally, a long time ago, humans thought that there was a fundamental difference between the stuff that organisms are made out of, which they called organic material, and non-living stuff. And they thought that it wasn't possible to convert one into the other because no one had done it yet. Now it's easily done. But anyway, that's why we started using the word organic. But really how we use the word now is as carbon containing. But it's not quite as simple as that. Unfortunately, there's exceptions to this. Chemically speaking, organic means containing carbon. But if you consider what you're probably writing with, or half of you are writing with, which is graphite, if you're using a pencil, it's not lead. We call it lead, but it's not. It's graphite. Graphite is pure carbon, one of several forms of pure carbon. Diamond is another. Pure carbon, obviously more expensive than graphite, but the... It's nothing but carbon atoms. Even though there's nothing but carbon, and it obviously contains carbon, graphite and diamond are not considered to be organic. And there are a couple other exceptions as well, like carbon dioxide is not considered to be organic. Almost all carbon-containing things are, though. It has to be a compound first. The element carbon is not considered organic. Compounds are, in the most cases, I just gave you the exception of carbon dioxide, that's the only one that'll matter in this class. But in almost all cases, organic compounds contain not only carbon, which they have to have in them to be organic to begin with, but usually hydrogen. And so organic compounds usually involve carbon-hydrogen bonds. And often oxygen and nitrogen, and it could be any other things as well. But hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen, and especially hydrogen and oxygen, are in there often. So anyway, humans thought that organic compounds, which living and dead things are made of, was somehow fundamentally different from non-living material. And... that's not the case. Now we can easily create in the laboratory organic compounds, the same sort of stuff that living things are made out of. There is no fundamental difference. But all organisms, regardless of what you're talking about, any organism is made up of organic compounds. Now, not every molecule or not every particle in an organism is organic, right? For instance, water is not organic. And you have a hell of a lot of water molecules in your body. It's not organic. There's no carbon in water. But your cells have plenty of organic compounds, including all four of the macromolecules that we've talked about already in this course. So what are these four macromolecule categories that all living things are made out of?
Amino acids.
Those aren't macromolecules. Those are building blocks that you can make macromolecules out of. Amino acids are not big molecules. Macro means big. So what are the four macromolecule categories? At this point, this should be pretty automatic in your mind. If it's not, then you're not spending enough time preparing day to day, and you're going to be disappointed. That's right. And proteins, by the way, are what you make out of amino acids. So amino acids are building blocks, but they're not macromolecules. So those four macromolecule categories that we just mentioned are not only macromolecules, they're all organic macromolecules. All living things have organic material making up their large molecules. And therefore, it's impossible to think of any organism without first thinking about organic molecules to make them out of. And this first slide has to do with the origins of life. Now, cell theory tells us that cells come from pre-existing cells. Cells don't just pop into existence, they come from pre-existing cells. But obviously there must have been some first cell, right? And that's true. Cells don't pop into existence anymore. But in early Earth, which is really different conditions from what there are now, there were no cells, and the first cells arose from non-cellular beginnings. Well, for that to happen, you already have to have on hand organic molecules, because all cells are made out of them. Okay? And so the question is, where did the organic molecules come from before there were any organisms? And this is a setup for a famous experiment conducted in the 50s originally, and then it was redone recently with much better results, although the original results were already good, to demonstrate that organic compounds without any life can get produced from inorganic precursor molecules that we know were there in early Earth, if you just give it enough time. And there was almost a billion years in early Earth's history before the first organisms arose. A billion years is a long time, I don't have to tell you. So what's happening here is this glassware setup is mimicking the early Earth conditions. So there's fire under this bulb with water in it. That's the ocean. Remember, that's where life started. The ocean was much hotter than it is now because Earth was, this was during the so-called Hadean Eon. Hadean means like hell. It was really hot. So that's why they're flaming it. And it's not just pure water. There are simple molecules that we know existed on early Earth, but no organic compounds. And this represents the atmosphere above it because it's evaporating from the sea, right? And in that atmospheric bulb there are two electrodes that are fitted, which can be sparked by the experimenters whenever. This represents lightning. So there's a billion years of lightning. You have a lot of energy that can be put into the situation, providing for the energy for chemical reactions between these inorganic precursor molecules. And just every once in a while, you just take a sample to see whether anything new has come about, any organic compounds that are in there. And it didn't take long. They just, you know, you run this for days and you start accumulating organic compounds out of inorganic sources. So that just shows you that organic compounds could have, without even any coming in from space, which is another way they could have gotten here, without even the help of that, inorganic molecules can get turned into organic compounds by ordinary chemical reactions without any organisms. That doesn't say how the first cells arose. That's more of a Bio-182 question, but that's why that is in here. All these organic compounds obviously feature carbon. So if we go to slide 2, we can look at some organic compounds. Now, all of these examples on this slide are not only organic, but more specifically, they are all examples of hydrocarbons. all hydrocarbons are organic, not all organic molecules are hydrocarbons. By the way, do not confuse the words hydrocarbon and carbohydrate. Hydrocarbons are named for the fact that the only thing in those compounds, and there's many, many hydrocarbons, but every hydrocarbon consists of only hydrogen and carbon, no other atoms. And you can see that's true for all these examples in this table and thousands of others. So a big branch of organic chemistry, which is already a huge branch of chemistry, deals with just hydrocarbons. Well, think back to when we talked about valence. What is the valence of an atom in general? I'm not looking for a number. I'm just saying, what's the definition of an element's valence? No, that's the number of electrons in the valence shell. There's multiple ways of using the word valence. So, for instance, oxygen has 6 valence electrons. That's the number of valence electrons. That's not the valence of oxygen. What is the valence instead? In words, yeah.
So it's how many it needs to be balanced, basically.
Right, how many additional electrons you have to add to that element, to that atom, to fill its outer shell. Its valence shell. Okay, so for oxygen it's 2, right? Because it needs to get to 8, it's at 6. So the valence is 8 minus 6, which is 2. Okay, but remember, practically, that the valence also tells you, if you're talking about nonmetals, which we are here because these are molecules, right? Molecules are made out of nonmetals, not metals and nonmetals. Anyway, the valence also tells you that's the number of bonds that it has to make, covalent bonds, in order for the molecule to be satisfied and all the atoms in that molecule to be satisfied. So, carbon has how many valence electrons? Yeah.
4.
It has 6 total, right, to balance it, 6 protons. 2 of those are in the inner shell, 4 are in the valence shell. And therefore, coincidentally, its valence is also 4. 8 minus 4 is 4. Okay? And we call that, in one word, tetravalence. That's a specialness of carbon. Carbon is not the only tetravalent element. Remember, things that are in the same group, which are the columns of the periodic table, have similar properties, including valence. So carbon's not the only one, but carbon is the only one that is as small as it is. It's the smallest tetravalent atom, and that makes it highly, highly versatile. There's a lot of different bonding that it can undergo, because it's going to make 4 bonds total, right? It can make 4 individual single covalent bonds, it can make 2 double bonds, it can make a triple bond and a single bond, and for all of those, it can do that with the same or different kinds of atoms. So it's more versatile than any other atom when it comes to making molecules, and that's its true specialness. Well, hydrogen has a valence of 1, right? Because that first shell holds only 2, so it's not 8 minus the 1 that hydrogen has, it's 2 minus the 1. So its valence is 1. And therefore, hydrogen, whatever molecule it's part of, each hydrogen atom is going to be forming 1 bond. That's all it can form. Hydrogen has to be making a total of 4. So if all you have are carbons and hydrogens, then every hydrogen that's bonded to a carbon in that molecule forms a single bond, and that counts toward 1, counts as 1 for the carbon. The simplest possible hydrocarbon is shown at the top, methane. Just a single carbon, that's why it's the simplest one. And it's saturated with hydrogens, right? 4 of them to satisfy the valence. Well, we notice that this word ends in A-N-E. Some hydrocarbons which are called alkanes. Whoops. Have nothing but single bonds. Not only do they only have carbon and hydrogen, but they have only single bonds. And alkanes is a general word. There are many examples of that. Methane is one, so is ethane. the alkane names end in A-N-E to tell you that they're alkanes. The alkenes have at least one double bond. And that's what's the difference between ethene and ethane. You see that? Carbons are double bonded, and then there's enough hydrogens to fill up the valence of the carbons. There are also alkynes, and their names will end in Y-N-E instead of E-N-E or A-N-E. Those feature a triple bond somewhere. Okay? And by the way, the prefixes of these, meth, eth, and so on, tell you how many carbons there are. Meth means one, eth means two, prop means three, like in propane, butane, that's four, and then they start using more familiar numerical prefixes, pent, hex, hept for seven, and so on. Yeah,
I was going to say, why did they just decide to make like meth, eth?
I don't really know the origin of that. It's a good question. Why didn't they just use uni, you mean, and buy or die? Yeah, they could have. There's a good reason, I'm sure. I just don't know the etymology of those. By the way, notice that when you get to 8, it's octane, which you're probably familiar with as a component of gasoline. Well, gasoline is really just a mixture of a bunch of different hydrocarbons, only one of which is octane. There's nonane in there, which is, or nonane, which is 9. There's hexane in there as well. It's a mixture. Well, speaking of gasoline, it's a hydrocarbon mixture, and gasoline is a really good fuel source, right? Because there's a lot of energy in it. We get a lot of energy out of burning it. Unfortunately, only a tiny amount of that energy goes into propelling you down the road. Most of it's wasted, but it has a lot of energy in it. Hydrocarbons in general make excellent fuel sources. And that's true outside the body, like for the gasoline burning engines, and it's also true in the body. Hydrocarbons are excellent fuel sources inside the body. We burn them more slowly than putting a lit match to gasoline, but it's the same reaction really. It's a combustion reaction inside our bodies. Now, why is it that they make such good fuels? Well, we're talking about hydrocarbons. Actually, I'll get to that question with a different slide, so put that off for a second. But while we're talking about hydrocarbons that are shown here in this slide, what have we already talked about when it comes to carbon and hydrogen? What is their relationship when it comes to covalent bonds? Well, yeah, go ahead.
It's just a shot, but is it that they have the same valence?
They don't have the same valence, because hydrogen is 1 and carbon is 4.
Yeah, polar?
They are not polar. The opposite of that. Carbon and hydrogen, whenever they form a covalent bond, it's a non-polar covalent bond, which means what to you? What makes it non-polar? Equal sharing of the two electrons that make up that bond. And so that's the next question then, is why is it equal sharing between carbon and hydrogen? Or between any atoms that are involved in a non-polar covalent bond? Why are non-polar bonds equally shared, the electrons? Yeah?
It's because of the same electron.
Right, exactly. If the two atoms involved have exactly or very close to the same electronegativity values, greediness for the electrons, in other words, then there will be equal sharing. And carbon and hydrogen both have fairly low electronegativities. Both of them are much lower than oxygen, but there's no oxygen in a hydrocarbon. So they share equally, and therefore hydrocarbons are nonpolar, which is why gasoline and water won't mix, because water is polar, right? Did you have a question, or did I just say something?
Why are non-polar bonds... Good question.
What makes a non-polar bond non-polar is that it's equal sharing of electrons.
Right.
And what makes it equal sharing is that the two atoms involved have pretty equal electronegativity values.
And that goes into that the opposites attract, kind of.
No, that's not what's keeping these together. What's keeping them together is the sharing of the electrons.
Right.
What keeps opposites together is happening in an ionic bond between a metal ion and a non-metal ion. Uh-huh. Okay, so these are just some simple hydrocarbons. Slide 3 shows you some things we've just been talking about, really, but it puts pictures to it. Valence of hydrogen is 1 because that's the special case of that first shell, only holds 2. 2 minus 1 is 1. Oxygen has 2, nitrogen has 3. Valences we're talking about, not electrons. Carbon's valence is 4. And that is much more versatile than these others. But what is common, do these all 4 of these things have in common? Not only are they all, they are the 4 elements that I said are the most abundant in your body or any organism's body, but even if it had nothing to do with biology, what is true of all 4 of these elements, chemically speaking? Well, we have element 1, and then we skip some, right? There's some in between hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen and carbon on the periodic table. They wouldn't belong to this set I'm asking about. What's true of these that's not true of the ones between hydrogen and oxygen? Right, you have hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, and so on. All 4 of these are nonmetals. Remember where the nonmetals are?
Above the staircase,
yes. Most elements are metals, but the nonmetals are those ones in the upper right plus hydrogen. Hydrogen, even though it's way on the left, that's a nonmetal as well.
That's the only outlier.
Yes. And so, what we have here are 4 atoms, nonmetals, that are not only nonmetals, but that they're simple nonmetals, because they're right there at the top. And they, therefore, when they form bonds, form covalent bonds, right? Which produces what kind of particles?
Molecules,
as opposed to formula units or salts, right? That metals and nonmetals make. So that's a fundamental difference in bonding type. So when we're talking about molecules, or modeling those molecules like we will later in the lab, we're talking about using primarily those 4. Slide 4 is a picture of a structural formula of urea. And the only reason I included this is to show you that not all, I already said this, but not all organic compounds have carbon-hydrogen bonds, but almost all of them do. This is a carbon and hydrogen are both in there, but notice that carbon isn't connected directly to any hydrogen in this one. This is still an organic compound, though. Urea is produced in the body, by the way, when you break down protein for fuel, which body doesn't usually do a lot of. Primarily, the body uses carbohydrates as fuel sugars. Those are the primary fuels. And it can break down fats and use the fatty acids as fuels. But you usually don't break down proteins for the purpose of using them as fuels. Proteins are mostly recycled in the body. We either break proteins down that are coming in as food, or we break down our own proteins into the amino acids that they started out as, and then we rearrange those amino acids and make brand new proteins out of them, so the amino acids get recycled. If you use them as fuel, though, the problem is that they contain nitrogen, and when you use them as fuel, you have to get rid of that nitrogen. It's gotten rid of in the form of ammonia, a nitrogenous or nitrogen-containing compound. And ammonia is toxic if it builds up. So the body doesn't allow that to happen. Instead, the liver, one of the many things it does that's good for you, is converts it into urea, which is also toxic at high levels, but not as toxic. It's more tolerable to the body. The urea then travels via the blood from the liver to the kidneys, which filters the blood. That's what urine formation is, to form urine, which contains urea. But it's an organic compound. It's also historically important because it was the first one, I think, urea was the first organic compound to be artificially synthesized. That's when we proved that you can eat, that you can make organic compounds out of inorganic compounds. So it's historically important as well. Let's go to 5, though, and talk about some more hydrocarbons. Notice that these are also all hydrocarbons, they're not just organic. But A, B, C, and D here represent different ways in which you can classify hydrocarbons. There are millions of possible hydrocarbons, and we've made millions of them. So it's important to be able to keep track of all of them. You classify them on different bases. So one basis on which you can classify them is the length of what we call the carbon skeleton. Any given organic compound has what we call the carbon skeleton, which just means however many carbons are in that molecule, they're usually connected together. That's the carbon skeleton. And then all the other types of atoms are connected to that skeleton. So the thing that's highlighted in each of these molecules is the carbon skeleton. Okay? Well, carbon skeletons can be of different sizes. This one has 2, this has 3. And that's why, notice the difference between these is the F versus the prop. That's how we're classifying these, based on the size of the carbon skeleton. In C, we'll go to C. I'm going to go to the right first. You can classify them on the basis of whether or not there are double bonds present. I mentioned this earlier when we were looking at the table. Not all hydrocarbons have double bonds. If they don't, they're alkanes. If there's at least one, they're alkenes. And notice these are both butene, because bute means 4 carbons. But there's 2 versions, because you can put that double bond here or here. Now, if you put it here, it's really the same as this thing, just flipped over, so it's not a really different molecule. That's why you have to use the 1 and 2 notation to denote the difference between those. On the bottom left, we have the basis used here is whether or not the carbon skeleton branches. Some carbon skeletons are linear, like you see here, just a line. Others have at least one branch. And appreciate the fact that the more carbons you have in your skeleton, the more possible branches there are. This is how you can really get into very, very many different compounds, even with the same exact number of carbons in them. Once you get to a higher number, there's all kinds of mathematical possibilities. But butane and 2-methylpropane, notice that they have exactly the same number of carbons and hydrogens, but they are different chemicals because those carbons are arranged differently. Okay? And then finally, you can categorize them on the basis of whether they have rings. Not all carbon skeletons come back and connect on themselves, but some do. We call those rings. And cyclohexane and benzene are examples of that. By the way, the next to cyclohexane, you have this simple polygon. This is really just shorthand for this. Chemists got sick and tired of drawing all the C's and H's, so they said, let's just represent it with lines that have angles on them. Every angle represents a carbon atom, unless that angle, that corner, is drawn with a different symbol. If there's no symbols, then you have to assume all of those are carbons. And then, knowing that the valence of carbon is 4, you just have to imagine enough hydrogens as are necessary to satisfy the valence. So this represents this, and all the information is there, even though it's kind of assumed. Yeah?
How do you tell the difference between length and branching in the first ones between ethane and butane?
You mean right here and here?
Yeah, wouldn't it be the same?
Well, yes. If you compared this and this, it would be only on the basis of length. But yeah, this is different from this on the basis that this is branched and this isn't. But they both have the same number of carbons. So that's what makes them different. Okay, let's go to 6 now and start talking about these four macromolecule types in a little bit more detail. We're looking at a single molecule that's really important in cartoon form here on the right. This, as you see, is a fat molecule. There are different kinds of fats, but this is an example of a fat. And you should not use the word fat and the word lipid interchangeably. They're not the same thing. All fats are lipids, but not all lipids are fats. So there are other kinds of important lipids, and we'll talk about them, but this is a fat. Now, that's one of its three names. It's fine to call it a fat. That's the easiest one to pronounce and to spell. But a fat can also be called a triglyceride. Which is what most biologists would call it. Most biochemists would call it by a third name, which is triacylglycerol. This one is actually the most descriptive of the words because it kind of tells you what it's made of. We'll talk more about that a little bit later, but fat is an important lipid because of these tails that it has. Now, the part of the molecule where all the tails are attached, this is a glycerol. If this were by itself, that would be a molecule unto itself, a glycerol molecule. And then attached to that glycerol are three fatty acid tails. That's what makes up a triglyceride. But if you consider just the fatty acid tail by itself, ignore the rest of it, how would you describe that thing chemically? Black, by the way, represents carbon. Red represents oxygen. And gray represents hydrogen. If you're talking about just one of these tails,
it's a nice long hydrocarbon.
It's a hydrocarbon, exactly. The fatty acid is a hydrocarbon except for the very end, as we'll see when we look at one in isolation. But the rest of the length is just hydrocarbon, nothing but carbons and hydrogens. And those make excellent fuels, like I said, right? This is why fat has such a high energy density compared to the other two major nutrient classes, which are carbohydrates and proteins. Fat stores a lot more energy per gram, more than twice as much. Proteins and carbohydrates store about the same amount of energy per gram. Fat stores a little bit more than double that. And that's why when we take in extra energy beyond what we need at the moment from our food, doesn't matter what it comes in as, we're going to convert it into fat to store it for later, because we can store the same amount of energy with less weight if we had to store our extra energy as carbohydrates or as proteins. Then we would have to weigh a lot more to carry around that stored energy. And we would waste energy to move then, because it would be more difficult to move around if we weighed more. Anyway, we'll talk more about that in a little bit. But slide 7 introduces the notion of isomers. What does iso mean? It means same. Like in isotopes, right? Isotopes are the same element, but they differ in their number of neutrons. Well, isomers are chemicals with the same exact chemical formula, but they're different substances. Now think about what I mean by a chemical formula. That's the string of symbols, right? So C6H14, whatever, that's a chemical symbol. I mean, that's a chemical formula. Two isomers will have exactly the same chemical formula, like these two examples right here. Pentane and 2-methylbutane, they both have exactly 5 carbons and exactly 12 hydrogens. So if you write C5H12, then you don't know what you're talking about. It's not enough information, right? Because there's multiple different chemicals with that same chemical formula. because there's different ways of arranging that carbon skeleton. So that's what isomers are in general. The same chemical formula, but different substances. Well, there are subcategories of isomers. What we saw is the example with pentane and 2-methylbutane. Those are structural isomers, because the difference is just a rearrangement of the carbon skeleton. Branch versus non-branch, for instance, as you see here. Okay? There are other kinds of isomers, though, that these other two that we need to get through, which second one is geometric isomers. Now, what's different about the geometric isomers compared to the structural isomer example on the top is that geometric isomers involve a double bond. And later today, you'll be in the lab playing around with ball and stick models, making molecules, making representations of molecules. Well, the sticks, which represent the bonds between the atoms, which are the balls, can be, you know, they represent a single bond. Each stick is a single bond. But you can, even with, before doing it ever, you can imagine that if you have two balls on a stick, they can swivel, right, with respect to each other. And therefore, anything that's connected to each ball will swivel. But if you have a double bond, it's not going to be able to swivel. So it holds everything that's connected to those two things in place. Okay, does that make sense? Well, those things that are represented here are hydrogen and anything else, which is what the X represents. So we have, for these two examples, two possibilities, the cis isomer and the trans isomer. Cis and trans are used in many different places. Cis means same side, trans means across or opposite side. Same things as in transgender and cisgender, for instance. So the cis isomer of two geometric isomers is the one that has the two other things on the same side. The X's here are on the same side, whatever X represents, right? In the trans isomer, the X's are on opposite sides. And you can't just swivel this thing because of the double bond to make the other one. So they are distinct molecules with their own properties. Okay, then that brings up enantiomers on the bottom. Enantiomers are examples of stereoisomers. Stereo means solid, referring to three-dimensionality. Enantiomers, not only are they examples of stereoisomers, but they are examples of compounds that we call chiral compounds. Anyone know what this word means? Chiral, it's an adjective. If it were the same root as in Cairo, which is just part of words, what words do you know with Cairo in them? Chiropractor, which is a person who works on you with his or her hands. Cairo means hand. A magician that does spells with his hands is a chiromancer, for instance. Anyway, chiral means handed. Now, molecules don't actually have hands, but it's a good analogy. If you look at your two hands, obviously there's a left version and a right version. Well, they're not the same thing. They're mirror images of each other, right? Which means if you cut off one of your hands, there's no way you can rearrange it in space to make it just like the other. They are different from each other. And similarly, if you have an organic molecule with a carbon at the center, and remember it's tetravalent, so it's going to form four bonds. If it's forming four single bonds, and more than that, forming those single bonds with four different things, like you see here, doesn't matter what these four corners are, if they're different from each other, and you build that molecule, which you could with a ball and stick model, There is no way that you can make the mirror image just by moving it around. You'd have to dismantle it and move some things around and rebond them in order to get the other version. So there's a left-handed version and a right-handed version. Similarly, a left-handed glove doesn't fit on a right hand, right? There's a left-handed glove and a right-handed glove. Those are enantiomers. And those are really important in biology because remember that we talked about a little bit about how chemical signals work. All chemical signals operate by binding to receptors. Otherwise, they do nothing. Well, a lot of these signals are actually enantiomers. There's a left-handed version and a right-handed version. Only one of those will work because the receptor is either right-handed or left-handed. And therefore, if you have the wrong-handedness for that receptor, it will not work. Won't recognize it. Oh, that this brings up the L and D notation. L is short for levo, which means left, and D is short for dextro, which means right. To be dexterous, for instance, really means to be right-handed. We're unfair to the left-handed people of the world in many ways, just because we're in the majority. Similarly, ambidextrous, the word ambidextrous really means having two right hands, because you can use them both like a normal right-handed person. Anyway, that's what those mean. And so when you see those in chemical names, like L-tryptophan was famous for a while because it's been debunked, but it's thought that that's what makes you tired at Thanksgiving. That's not what makes you tired. But it's L-tryptophan, that's levotryptophan, because there's a dextro version as well, but organisms don't use that. Brings us to slide 8. Here we see examples of enantiomers. So these are chiral compounds, and these both happen to be signals like I was talking about. Ibuprofen, albuterol. Well, for each one of them, there's a right and a left-handed version. You might have noticed that there's no D's and L's here. That's because the D and the L system is only one way we distinguish them. There's also the S and the R system, where the left-handed people get shortchanged again. S stands for sinistral, which there's nothing wrong with that word. It just means left. But the similar word sinister, which means left-handed, we use that to mean people who are suspicious. They're weird because they're left-handed. Well, it's not really weirdness, but that's what it means. The R is short for recto, like in rectangles, because they have right angles. Right means right. So, point here is that both of these two different signals, chemical signals, drugs, they're drugs because they're exogenous signals, right? We don't make these in the body. These are drugs manufactured. There's a right and a left-handed version for each of these, but only one of them will work in the body because they work only by binding to receptors. And you can't say that it's always the right-handed one that you need because it depends. It's a case-by-case basis. For ibuprofen, the effective version is the left-handed one, the sinistral one. Whereas for albuterol, and that's because there's a left-handed receptor in the body. For albuterol, the receptor is right-handed, so only the right-handed or recto version will work. Even though they're mirror images of each other and they really seem like exactly the same molecule, it's how they interact with other things that matters. And they don't interact the same because they're mirror images. Similarly for L-DOPA and D-DOPA, shown in slide 9. Now the difference here, these are signals as well, but these are endogenous signals, right? The body makes these. Well, we don't make D-DOPA because we don't have receptors for D-DOPA. It would be, therefore, silly for the body to make D-DOPA. The body makes L-DOPA because we have receptors for the left-handed version. Okay, now to 10. Some of you might recognize what we're looking at. Well, we're looking at estradiol and testosterone. Estradiol is the main estrogen that the body produces. Testosterone is a different hormone, but what do these both come from? Did I mention this already? The more courses and the more sections I teach, the more I can't remember whether I've mentioned it in here or somewhere else. But these estrogens and progesterones and testosterone, those are all steroid hormones, right? They also all happen to be sex hormones. There's other steroid hormones besides sex hormones. But all of the steroid hormones in the body start out as the same thing. They're just slight modifications of a molecule that looks very much like this, which is cholesterol. Cholesterol itself uses this "ster" part in its name. By the way, the reason that it ends in OL, that tells us that it's an alcohol. More about that later. The "ster," I said, means solid. Coal refers to bile. So cholesterol really means bile solid alcohol. And it's a component of bile that the liver makes. But cholesterol is important in its own right because it's an important component of cell membranes, plasma membranes. It's also, though, vitally important because we make all of our steroid hormones simply by modifying cholesterol to start with. And it's not much of a modification. If you look at cholesterol, it's almost exactly each of these. So you don't have to drastically change cholesterol to get these things. And just comparing these two, estrogen is a feminizing hormone, testosterone is a masculizing hormone. They have drastically different effects in the body, right? But they don't have drastically different structures. They have very, very small changes in structure, differences in structure. And that's because the main part of it, which is this ring structure that cholesterol also has, is really not involved in how these things work as signals. What's involved are the things that are hanging off of that main part of the molecule. And they're shaded here. Not all of them are shaded, but you see some shadings. These things that are small collections of atoms, not the entire molecule, but some collection of atoms that hang off of the main part of the molecule are called functional groups. And they're called functional groups because that particular arrangement of atoms gives that molecule some sort of function by allowing it to interact with other things like signal molecules do. Okay? So that's why estrogen and testosterone have such drastic differences. There's this functional group here in testosterone that's not there in estrogen. And therefore, it functions differently by interacting with other molecules differently. Okay, well, we're going to be talking about functional groups coming up right now. Slide 11 is a table from the book, but it's really all one table in the book. In this, as we can see, it's two different slides. But each column, which is a different functional group, has some important things in it listed in the rows. At the top, of course, is the name of the functional group. And we'll go through these left to right. First is the hydroxyl group. Now, by the way, this is not an exhaustive list of functional groups. If this were an organic chemistry course, you'd be learning a lot more different kinds of functional groups. But these are the real biggies when it comes to biology, the ones we're going to cover in this course. Hydroxyl is first shown. Now, there's nothing to the order of it. This just happens to be the first one shown. Hydroxyl, any given functional group, not just hydroxyl, any functional group is not a complete molecule. It is just part of what a whole molecule would be. But we just imagine it in isolation from the rest of the molecule. And therefore we can draw it either in ball and stick form or just in structural formula form as its own functional group. When you draw it in ball and stick form, as I said, red represents oxygen and gray represents hydrogen. That's what makes up a hydroxyl. And that's why it's called hydroxyl, right? It's a hydrogen and an oxygen. It explains the name. But importantly, the ball and stick model for this shows you that it's not a complete molecule, right? It has a stick representing a bond that isn't connected to anything else. in this figure? Well, it has to be connected to something else for it to be a complete molecule. In a complete molecule, all valences are satisfied. So this just shows you this isn't a complete molecule. Okay. In structural formula form, we can draw it as OH with a dash. The dash represents the bond with whatever else. So that's one way. You could also, though, draw it with an R and then a dash and OH. The R's are omitted in this just for simplicity, but sometimes you see R's in these structural formulas. Well, if you look at the periodic table, there is no element whose symbol is R, and so it doesn't represent a specific thing. R just stands for residue, which simply means the rest of the molecule. It can be anything else. Okay, but usually that R involves the carbon skeleton directly. It's just the rest of the molecule, though. Okay. Now, you could also actually flip this. So you could draw a hydroxyl as shown, dash OH, but you could also write it as HO dash, because there's nothing saying it's in that direction, right? But notice that you cannot write it as dash HO or OH dash. What's wrong with those? It's saying that the bond hooking it to the rest of the molecule is from hydrogen, and hydrogen already has a bond with oxygen. When you draw the two symbols together with no line in between them, that's just shorthand as well. There's really a line between them. So hydrogen is already making one bond. That's all it can make, right? It has a valence of one. So not only is this impossible for hydrogen, but oxygen is not satisfied in that case, right? Because it has to make two bonds. That's why the dash is associated with always with the oxygen. Oxygen is making one bond with hydrogen and one bond with the residue. Okay, is that all clear? Now, what is it? I mean, if a molecule, if an organic compound has a hydroxyl group in it somewhere, and it can have more than one, but if it has a hydroxyl group, an OH, then we call that an alcohol. Now, there's all kinds of different alcohols. And I don't mean all kinds of beverages, because no matter whether you're talking about beer, wine, or booze, any alcohol that you should ever drink has exactly the same alcohol in it. That's ethanol. Notice at F means same thing as it does for ethane. In fact, ethanol means alcohol that's otherwise just like ethane, ethane alcohol. So that's the only one that you'd ever drink, but there's thousands and thousands of other kinds of alcohol, including cholesterol, right? Cholesterol is named for the fact that it is an alcohol. In general, chemical names that end in OL are named that way to show you that they are alcohols, and therefore there is at least one hydroxyl in that molecule somewhere. Now, these are... These compounds, these alcohols, because of their hydroxyl groups, are polar. And that makes them important in how they interact with other things in the body. Why are they polar? How should you already know, even though it says it up there, you should already know that a hydroxyl group is polar. Why? Yes, but why is it unequal sharing? Exactly. Oxygen's electronegativity is much higher than hydrogen's. So if you have an OH bonded together with a covalent bond, it's going to be unequal sharing and therefore make that compound polar. Okay, next is the carbonyl group. Now notice that the carbonyl group features a carbon double bonded to an oxygen. That's alone is what makes it a carbonyl. But unlike hydroxyl, there's a couple possibilities here. Notice the difference here is that the carbon, in order to satisfy its valence, needs to make two additional bonds. It's already making two with carbon, I mean with oxygen. It needs to make four overall. So it needs to have two more bonds. And that's why there are two possibilities with respect to where this carbonyl can be in the molecule. And therefore, carbonyl-containing compounds aren't just all called the same thing. There's two categories of carbonyl-containing compounds, and those are aldehydes and ketones. Okay, now there's many aldehydes and there's many ketones, but those are the two categories of carbonyl-containing compounds. So let me explain the difference. And you can see some in the pictures here. Acetone is an example of a ketone. Propanol is an example of an aldehyde. By the way, just like OL ending tells you it's an alcohol, things that end in ONE tell you that it's a ketone. Things that end in AL tell you that it's an aldehyde. But what's the difference? What's the fundamental difference in these two placements within the carbon skeleton? Well, they're both carbonyl containing. I mean, they're both carbonyl groups, so they're both carbon double bonded to an oxygen. But for ketones, that carbonyl group is not at a tip of the skeleton. The skeleton doesn't just have just two tips necessarily. It does in this example, but the more branches you have, the more tips you have, right? Any tip is not where this carbonyl is if it's going to be a ketone. If it's anywhere in the skeleton other than a tip, then it's a ketone. If the carbonyl, on the other hand, is at a tip, and it can be any of the tips, then what we have is an aldehyde. Okay? And that's why the hydrogen is taking up the place here, which could have been another carbon, right? But if it's another carbon, then that would make it not at the tip. Everyone understand that? Okay, so that's what makes the difference between ketones and aldehydes, the placement of the carbonyl. And I used to mix them up until it dawned on me one day that this might help you. That the word ketone starts with K, the word aldehyde starts with A. A is at one tip of the alphabet, and K is somewhere in the middle of the alphabet. So ketones, you know, you can follow that mnemonic if it helps you. Ketones are somewhere in the middle of the carbon skeleton, whereas aldehydes are at the tip. Okay, well, we'll talk about aldehydes and ketones more when we talk about sugars a little bit more later, but they're really important in biology as major fuels. Next is carboxyl. And if you look at a carboxyl, even before reading anything about it, it really looks like it is two functional groups in one, right? It looks like it's a carbonyl plus a hydroxyl. And it is, actually. But for this particular case, a carbonyl also with a hydroxyl right on it in just this configuration, we don't consider to be two different functional groups. Instead, we lump them together as one functional group called the carboxyl. But notice that the word itself is a combination of carbonyl and hydroxyl, carboxyl. Okay, one functional group. And carboxyl-containing compounds, compounds that contain the carboxyl group, at least one of them, are called carboxylic acids because that carboxyl group gives it acidic behavior. They're carboxylic acids. Another name for them, not as common, is organic acids. Because when you think about the famous acids like hydrochloric acid or anything like that, there's no carbon in it, right? Hydrogen and chlorine for hydrochloric acid, for instance. Sulfuric acid doesn't have any carbon in it. So those are inorganic carbons. Well, carboxyl obviously has carbon in it. So we're talking about an organic acid here. That's why they're also called that. But carboxylic acids is the more frequently used term. Acetic acid is an example shown here. It is the example shown here. Acetic just means vinegar. Or the acet part of that word means vinegar. So acetic acid means acid of vinegar. It's not the only place that you have acetic acid, but when you smell vinegar, that's acetic acid. And that's why even artificially flavored salt and vinegar potato chips that instead of using real vinegar, just use acetic acid, will smell the same. It's the acetic acid of vinegar that makes it smell that way. Anyway, it's just one example of a carboxylic acid. Well, in biology in general, carboxyl-containing compounds, and therefore carboxylic acids, are really important because, among other things, they include the amino acids. Amino acids, you can't overstate the importance of, because they're the fundamental building blocks or monomers of proteins, right? Proteins do all the important jobs in the cell, or they're at least directly involved with all the important jobs. And so without proteins, it's impossible to think of life. You can't have proteins without amino acids. Every single amino acid has a carboxyl in it. Okay, let's go on to the next, which is the amino group. Now, whenever you see A-M-I-N, whether it's amino, amine, amin, and something else as a root, that refers to nitrogen. There's going to be a nitrogen in there somewhere if you see that word root, including the word amino as a functional group itself. Notice the structural formula. It's a nitrogen singly bonded to two different hydrogens, and then also bonded to the residue. Why only three here? Because nitrogen's valence is three. Right? It's not tetravalent, like carbon is. It needs to form three bonds because it has five in its outer shell already. So the compounds that contain at least one amino group are called amines. And there's many different kinds of amines. But included in those amines are amino acids. So all amino acids are amines, but not all amines are amino acids. Just amino acids by themselves, though, makes this an indispensable molecule in biology for what I was just saying. The amino acids are the monomers that you need to build proteins. Well, let's look at glycine here as the example. Glycine is just one of the 20 biological amino acids. It happens to be the simplest possible one. But what is shaded is the amino group, right? And obviously amino acids are partially named for the fact that they have an amino group, right? That explains the amino part of the phrase amino acid. Where does the acid come from? Well, look at the other side of this same glycine molecule, on the other side of the central carbon. What is this unshaded functional group right here? That's a carboxyl, which means this thing is in addition to being an amine, this thing is also a carboxylic acid, right? Anything containing a carboxyl is a carboxylic acid. So the overall phrase, amino acid, refers to both of these important functional groups. Every amino acid has both of these functional groups, otherwise it's not an amino acid. And we make proteins out of these, so they are indispensable. Sulfhydryl is next. Now the sulfhydryl, if you look at the formula, is a sulfur bonded to a hydrogen, and then the sulfur is also bonded to the residue. What is this very similar to that we've already gone over? It's very similar to a hydroxyl, right? Except instead of an oxygen, you have a sulfur. Well, look at the periodic table and find sulfur. Where is it? Right under oxygen. In other words, in the same group. Remember, things that are in the same group have the same properties, including valence. So sulfur also has a valence of 2, just like oxygen. And this is just like a hydroxyl, only with sulfur in it instead of oxygen. That's the basis for the name. It chemically works kind of like a hydroxyl because it's so similar to hydroxyl. But the things that contain sulfhydryls are not called alcohols, they're called thiols. Well, notice the word thiol itself ends in O-L, which would mean that it's an alcohol. It's not really an alcohol, though. The thi, or thio, part of that means sulfur. Sulfur-containing compounds usually have thio somewhere in the name. So thiol was an invented word meaning sulfur alcohol. It's not really an alcohol, but it's like an alcohol with sulfur instead of hydrogen. Okay, now cysteine is the example shown here. This cysteine, by the way, is another amino acid. And if you look at this, you can see the amino group and the carboxyl group that it has to have to be an amino acid. But this fourth spot, which for glycine was filled up with just a hydrogen, can be anything else. It's the R group of the amino acid. And in cysteine, there's a sulfhydryl in that R group. And that is important because if a protein contains multiple cysteine amino acids, it's made up of a bunch of different amino acids, but if multiple ones somewhere in that chain of amino acids are cysteine, and if the protein folds up into three dimensions in such a way that those cysteine amino acids get close to each other, even though they're not next to each other as beads on the string, then the two sulfhydryl groups will react chemically. Each one will lose its hydrogen so that the two sulfurs get covalently bonded together. And this really locks the protein in that shape. It really strengthens the shape of it. Important for stabilization. And there's a lot of this in human hair, for instance, which is why if you burn human hair accidentally or for fun, it smells like sulfur because you're breaking those sulfhydryl bonds. It's also why home permanent kits smell like sulfur, because you have to break those cross bridges between cysteines, which are called disulfide bridges, in order to straighten the hair or curl it. Phosphate is the next one. And phosphate is the most complex in terms of the number of atoms of the ones we're studying in this class. Notice that it's a phosphorus atom centrally placed, and then four oxygens, one of which is bonded to the one of those oxygens is bonded to the residue. Also, notice that this is a charged functional group, and that's really important to biology that I'll talk about in a minute. But anyway, the phosphate group is important for a lot of different reasons. We call things that contain the phosphate group organic phosphates because the residue contains carbon and therefore makes the overall molecule organic. Really important for a variety of reasons, like I said. One is that we wouldn't exist without them even close, because every organism has to be made of at least one cell, right? Every cell has to have a plasma membrane in order to define the cell. And every plasma membrane is made chiefly of phospholipids, which, as the name implies, are lipids that contain phosphate groups. That alone is enough to make it indispensably important. But phosphate is also important because it occurs in ATP, adenosine triphosphate. It's the main temporary energy storage molecule for energy transactions in all cells, ATP. In addition, that by itself is paramount. But even beyond that, we also have phosphate group appearing in every single nucleotide. Now, what is a nucleotide? A nucleotide is the monomer, or the building block, that we use to string together to make nucleic acids, which is one of those four biological molecules, right? DNA and RNA are nucleic acids. You can't make either of them unless you use building blocks, each of which contains a phosphate group. That, without DNA, there's no life. And still another important thing about phosphates is that they are shuttled from one molecule to another, traded off, on and off, in a process, two processes called phosphorylation and dephosphorylation. Phosphorylation is simply sticking a phosphate onto something else. Dephosphorylation is removing it. And this is a major way, usually it's a protein of some sort that's either phosphorylated or dephosphorylated. This is a major way in which cells control the functions of their proteins. Now, I think I've said before that whatever specific function a given protein has, it has that specific function because of its shape, right? And if you need a protein to do whatever its job is, obviously you need to create it first as the cell. You need to create that protein if you need that protein to do a particular job. Now, if you don't need that protein to do that, I mean, you don't need that job to be done anymore after a while, you could destroy the protein. Because if it continues to exist, it's going to continue doing the job even if you don't want it to. Right? So you could turn it off, so to speak, by destroying it, breaking it down into individual amino acids again and recycling them. That's going to stop it from working, right? But what if then the next moment you need it again? Well, you'd have to go build it again, which is expensive. It takes energy to build the protein from amino acid subunits. So it'd be much nicer and it would be faster if you could just have a switch on it that would put it into usable form and inactive form. And that's what phosphorylation and dephosphorylation do, because when you stick that phosphate onto the protein, it changes its shape. And when you take it back off, it changes the shape back to the other conformational shape. And it's not necessarily true that a phosphorylated one will be turned on and a dephosphorylated one will be turned off. It depends on the specific protein. But this is the major way in which cells can control whether or not proteins such as enzymes, for instance, can be switched on or off quickly without destroying and having to rebuild the protein itself. That leaves only methyl in the ones that we're going to study. And methyls are pretty ubiquitous, meaning they occur all over. You see them all in all kinds of molecules because they're kind of like space fillers. Right, any given carbon skeleton can have multiple tips, like I said, especially if there's high branching. And whatever carbon is at the end of that, like any other carbon, it needs to form four bonds. But if it's at a tip, it's not forming a bunch of bonds with other things unless you fill those bonds just with hydrogens, the simplest atoms. So that's what a methyl group basically is, a carbon bonded individually to three different hydrogens. And to form that fourth bond, the carbon is connected to the residue, the rest of the molecule. You find them all over. Things that have them in them are called methylated compounds, reasonably enough. And this is kind of similar to phosphate in terms of controlling things. Usually phosphorylation controls proteins. Methylation and demethylation can be used to control DNA. Each of your cells has DNA, the same set of DNA, right? Which is the full library for your body. Every individual cell has that. So every cell has all the genes, and therefore every cell has the information necessary for how to build all of your thousands of different proteins that you could make. But no cell ever comes close to building all of those because there are proteins that are only do their job normally in certain kinds of cells, right? You don't want to build fingernail proteins in the liver, even though the liver cells have the ability to. And it can happen abnormally sometimes, but you don't want it to happen, right? So you do that by turning certain genes off for your entire lifetime. And one way you can do that is by methylating the DNA, and that makes it inaccessible. It makes it unreadable by the cell, so it basically ignores it. And it could be permanent, or you could do this reversibly. You could unmethylate it to make it now readable, and so you could turn that gene on. All right, that's pretty good timing. We'll stop there and resume at 13.